Bandwidth for MacBreak Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
You're listening to MacBreak Tech, decompiling the 2007 Apple Worldwide Developer Conference. We now join a conversation already in progress.
How I overheard some developers saying, you know, all that objective stuff I learned, I guess it doesn't make as much difference anymore.
Now that you're talking about them opening up the languages that you can use to write Cocoa stuff.
Yeah, and that, you know, that they're even pushing Python and Ajax and JavaScript themselves.
I think I actually had to wipe a few tears away when I heard about the Python
part. Yeah, I know. I was thinking of you, Ben.
It was a touching moment.
Did you see that checkout? There's an application called Checkout, and what it does, it's basically a point of sale device, aka POS, but it's not a POS. It's really cool that lets you use a Mac Mini or other suitable Mac to run your store, your retail store.
Okay,
and the whole thing was written in Interface Builder and JavaScript, not JavaScript and Python, and so they have a mere 20,000 lines of code running this store.
Wow!
And they
for point of sales
for point of sales, and so they leverage all kinds of WebKit stuff for, you know, being able to display an invoice or a whatever, which means that they can email that stuff off to somebody else. Right. It means that if somebody needs, you know, more stuff, they can pretty much easily leverage it.
Hmm.
But it was pretty cool because when you look at the app. And I've seen, I watched the app during beta because a friend of mine has a store and he wanted to you know, automate some the sales. Who knew that it was in Python?
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it looks just like a normal old Cocoa app,
right?
And or in this case, a better way to say it, just a normal old Macintosh running in the.
It's indistinguishable from a object oriented or an Objective C program,
right.
As versus a Java or Python or whatever.
You know, and from a, you know, they're using the a database, and we don't know which one it is. So, you know, the SQL call into that is not dependent on C or the language itself, because the lookup's going to happen however fast the lookup happens.
Right.
However the tables were set up. So when that gets spit back out, there you go. And so you just need to know what the construct is to get to pass the data.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good question for people who aren't used to the sort of nuances or aren't unfamiliar with the nuances between languages. Why would someone care that we can now do this in Python or something like that?
Well,
I do. I was wondering. I'm
as someone like
subtitling.
Craig Saverson might.
I'm trying to resist subtitling the show because I know the show is not about subtitles.
So,
but I am here.
The thing that I know, having worked in all different kinds of languages throughout my life, is that the fastest way to build something is with a scripting language.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to worry about...
HyperCard! Oh, sorry.
Yeah, well, that's a good example of a scripting language.
I loved my HyperCard.
So you don't have to worry about memory management. You don't have to worry about garbage collection. You don't have to worry about speed or whether it's going to compile or any of that, because it's going to it runs on the fly.
Right. And you see errors immediately if your script doesn't work. It doesn't work.
And so that's been the real bugaboo for me with learning JavaScript, is because there hasn't been a really good debugger in the language up until recently.
It's also I always hesitate to learn or to spend a lot of time, not necessarily just learn, but to spend a lot of time on a language if there's only one type of opportunity for me to use it. Like, I don't know what I would do outside of Apple desktop development with Objective-C and Ruby the same way. It's a beautiful language. And for the object-oriented purists, it's like the pinnacle there. But unless I'm going to do Rails, which you can do in a bunch of different languages now, you can do Rails-like stuff elsewhere. Sort of the need to spend a lot of time on that particular, sort of, to me, almost a one-off language for what I would use it for. I'm sure I'm going to offend someone out there. But so that's opening it up again to be able to be in the language that you want to be in or that you're most comfortable in. Just everyone's comfortable with what they've used before. That's
what do you mean? You don't like Fortran?
I don't know Fortran.
Oh, there's an article, and we'll have to dig it up for everyone to find. But they equated C being the new assembler language.
Mm-hmm.
that, mm-hmm. you know, there was really no reason to write in.
Unless you're Steve Gibson, then you actually are still writing assembly language.
Right. Didn't he write his website in assembly?
Yeah, supposedly I don't know if it's still his web server.
I remember him talking about that. Wow. In an
total masochist.
Yeah. That's pretty hard.
But it's minute and runs very fast.
Sure it does, yeah.
Well, but what's the point, right? If you have a really fast processor and you're running Apache, if you look at your server loads, mm-hmm. even when the server's under load and you've got a you're basically barely even scratching what your limits are, what your server's capable of.
Yeah, you lost me already. It's great. I'm just resisting because
I think you should take advantage of the fact that we have a subtitler here. I think you should subtitle away.
Well, okay, just one thing. I want to know in general blocks of when you guys talk about languages, you talk about scripting, you're talking about Python and C. Are there levels to these things? Like, I know what I learned when I was at WWDC is all the levels involved in the Apple system, which was fascinating. Mm-hmm. But what are the general chunks of levels when you guys are talking about programming languages?
And when you're talking about levels, you're talking about the different architectural levels,
not necessarily
in Mac and the OS.
Yeah, but
there's a similar sort of concept with languages too. Okay. I mean, one easy way to think of it, just off the top of my head, would be distance from the processor or distance from the hardware. Right. Mm. So if you're coding in assembly, you're coding directly to the hardware. Or I was talking to a friend at a game company that they're bypassing DirectX and or OpenGL, and they've actually written stuff that goes direct to specific graphics hardware cards to do optimizations that they need for their game development.
That's known as writing to the metal.
Writing to the metal. You've said that a few times last week, and I was like, what does that mean?
You don't need to write to the metal. I mean, if for most of the things that you're ever going to do.
Actually, video games and cell phones are pretty much one of the two areas, and then especially like military applications or things like that, that need to write to the metal itself much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that just increases your development time by a lot, because
look at how long it takes to develop certain games or certain, you know, why does it take military or car manufacturers so long to get certain things in their cars or their vehicles? Mm. Because they're writing to the metal.
Pedal to the metal.
Yeah. Anyways.
So then as you drift up, so you can think of it like C would be a step away from that. You're not writing in assembly anymore, but you do have to take care of some of these low-level considerations like how you're managing your memory and things like that. You drift up one more level to these scripting languages or whatever, and you're just further away from those considerations and you're able to concentrate just what does it need to do, the sort of internal plumbing is, you can get down there if you need to get to it, but it's sort of hidden from you if you want to prototype, for instance.
And theoretically, it's very efficient. So it's the scripting language's management of said things is...
Well, it's less efficient in terms of like processor time and execution speed.
And memory allocation.
And that's why people drift back down if they need to optimize for something like that. But if you're writing something that you just need to see, will this concept work and can I get it thrown together, if you're familiar with the language, you should be able to prototype faster.
And there's abstraction layers there too that you can go between. A lot of times you can use parts of a higher level language, is what they're sometimes known as, and a lower level language. Mm-hmm. So you can mix them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't mix well. It just depends on what you're working on. The architectural slides that you might have seen at Worldwide Developer Conference for different layers, or that you can even find on Apple's website, are different abstraction layers that sometimes play together, and sometimes you have to use one higher level to before you can get to that lower level. Yeah. So it just depends on what you're trying to do a lot of times.
So a good example of an app, a commercial app that was made using a scripting language is Adobe Lightroom. Mm-hmm. It was made, written with a language called Lua.
Okay.
And so Lua is very similar to...
You mean Luau.
No, Lua. Luau, that's like nothing's going to get done with that language. Except for maybe, you know, some of that. But the idea was that they were able to make this app outside of the constructs of using the Adobe libraries. And they were able to make this app from the ground up in a fairly short amount of time. Mm. So they started it, I would say... Well, there's a whole story about how they were able to prototype it and make it and get it to market as quickly as they did. Mm. Also, because they used the scripting language, they were able to do the port fairly quickly. Once the application framework, the interface framework, the graphical interface was done, then it was just a matter of plugging that all that in.
So when you guys talk about Python or Ruby, are these scripting languages?
These are scripting languages.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you talk about
AppleScript. That's a scripting language.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Yep.
JavaScript.
Sounds like a scripting, script is scripting
language. So what's an object-oriented language? Give me an example.
Well, all of these languages mm-hmm. that you've just described,
yes.
or that you've just named,
yes.
are all object-oriented languages.
Okay, so object-oriented is a generic term for...
well, it typically means you can encapsulate a specific function in a piece of code and reutilize it without having to rewrite it. So you save the way it's thinking of a car, you know. If I put a tire on a car, there's four tires, and it's an object that goes on the car. So in essence, that tire is an object in, okay. in the mm-hmm. code of the car.
You can it allows you to, from a design standpoint,
yeah.
create these entities in the program that can do things that you ask them to do, and then can also contain some data about themselves that can be used, mm-hmm. or about other things mm-hmm. that can be used as mm-hmm. well. So instead of it just being... calling a huge library of functions yeah. where it's, you know, do some type of work, do some other type of work, and you're passing data in. Mm-hmm. You can architecturally think of it as this collection of things that are communicating with one another or having, you know, some master communication okay. that's talking to all of them. But mm-hmm. it's mostly a design thing. And yeah. most modern languages, even the scripting ones, have full object orientation. Mm-hmm. You can pick the nits about whether or not they're fully object right. oriented.
Yeah. So okay. a good example is this object is glass. Mm-hmm. And glass contains some properties. It's paper, has lid, it's half
glass
full.
Glass is paper? Wait a minute.
And it, uh-huh. you know, what it contains. And so you can pull all that data out yeah. of this single object. So yeah. you don't have to keep defining.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
got it.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to.
It's a module.
Have, right.
It's kind of
so instead of having 16 variables running around in your code, you yeah. can have one, and it's this object, yes. the glass object.
Okay, got it.
So... Now, right. actually, out of curiosity, yeah. this is your first WWDC,
It was
right?
indeed, yes.
And was it your guys'
It
first?
Was mine, yeah, yeah. it was mine. Yeah.
So I'm the only one I think it's been to. Had you been before?
I went to the very
oh,
first
yes,
one.
Oh, yes, first one.
I went to the very
ago.
First one.
That's right.
Back when it was at the, it wasn't at the Fairmont, it was at the one little tiny hotel in
Capri Motor
Sunnyvale.
Oh, in Sunnyvale.
yeah.
Oh, okay.
And it was probably at the Westin.
Right.
Somebody probably knows this. I don't remember.
See, I've gone to a couple of them.
But it was only 2 days, and one day they had 2 days and two tracks, and one of the tracks was Apple IIgs.
Nice.
Oh. So they were talking about the internals of, you know, of this really
advanced.
I don't know, it was like the extension of Apple DOS.
So what do you think of all the geekdom at this
it was
conference?
Great. it was great. I mean, it was.
Were you walking around asking everyone to subtitle their conversations?
No, I realized
you saying such and such.
Yeah, you know, it would have been too overwhelming. I just sort of like deer in the headlights, like, oh my God. And I went into a session because a friend of mine was actually playing guitar during the session. And so, you know, I just walked in, oh, you know, I'll check this out. And boy, you know, I was just stunned. At the level of, you know, geekery that was going on. And impressed, I must say, it was really impressive mm-hmm. To see the inner workings of the whole Apple system and how it, you know, how it actually goes together and what makes it special mm-hmm. under the hood. I really got a sense of that and really understood a lot more about, for instance, why the keynote was the way that it was.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, that there wasn't a whole lot of really cool stuff happening at the consumer, you know, level, but the stuff that's going on underneath in terms
the
of
under the hood stuff
with Leopard is pretty impressive. So it was a really great experience in that way.
I wish that we could have reached out to everybody that had listened to specifically MacBreak Weekly. Because they were really saying, oh, there wasn't very exciting, there wasn't anything to see. And the thing was, is that, you know, as I spent more time at the conference, mm-hmm. of course, I was also looking at it from developers' eyes right from the very beginning.
Sure.
So I was excited about the keynote and everything that was there. Mm-hmm. But as it unveiled itself throughout the week, I was like, you know, this is probably the most exciting OS that Apple shipped in a long, long
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing, too, for me... about this, you know, looking at this, was their emphasis on the web. Now, yes. there's a lot of things yeah. we can't mm-hmm. talk about because we're under NDAs after going to the show.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's certain things about that. My thing that I took away from it, and it was talked about outside of the conference, is things like the use of iframes, for example, which I've been a big supporter of web technologies like that for a long time. And was interesting that, you know, hearing Apple and others say, oh, okay, start using these technologies for things like the iPhone and and in general use them for web development. And really the emphasis on web development at the conference was very interesting in my opinion.
Yeah, especially like with Safari on Windows was just an indication of that. I think it was almost a metaphor for kind of what's happening there.
And they have to a certain degree, because what's going to drive content for the iPhone and make the user, you know, they're kind of on the hook for keeping that Apple user experience. And yet with a web device being one of their, you know, one of their new products that's coming up, they're wanting to do as much proselytization and education as they can about these technologies, specifically the web technologies that are going to make the iPhone experience.
Exactly.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, part of it, I believe, and I've been a non-supporter of web based things for long since the web came out, because I believe that the web pushed us back 20 years in terms of graphical user interface and usability. And there's a lot of people that say, oh, you can do way more stuff with this, but the idea of clicking and waiting, I mean, this process takes a long time.
Yes.
When we know we can do predictive and send this data down so that we always, the user's never having to wait. And we can do that now with Ajax technologies. And, you know, it's just the tip of the iceberg on this.
Yeah. You mean that cleaner stuff? Oh, sorry. Different Ajax.
Ajax. Yeah, I guess there is a distinction. You know what? Don't put Ajax on your iceberg. Then you won't be able to drink the water on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things we talked about, I was really excited about the scripting language stuff, but I was more excited about Quartz Composer and the continuation of what we saw in 10.4. So have you ever played with Quartz Composer, Ben?
I've seen a couple things that people have done with it, but I haven't played with it myself.
So you haven't.
I don't even know what it is.
Okay.
And I definitely have.
Yeah. So the idea is that it's a graphical scripting language.
Okay.
So instead of having to type a bunch of words, or it's, I would say, incantations, because that's a lot of times what it looks like. And, you know, you get your head around this, and eventually you go, oh, okay, this is what I'm doing. This thing lets you visually see that I'm taking this variable and I'm stuffing it into this property of this thing.
What do you mean I don't have my glib and call of...
What do you need that
specifically
for
doing graphics operations? That's the thing. Yeah. It allows you to do compositing of various types, but like John's saying, you're able to do it with this little node-based... It's almost like working in something like Shake, where you're just wiring operations together.
Yeah, I see.
And there they're little black boxes. Right.
So instead of typing command lines, you're building a Shake kind of thing.
That's exactly what it's like. Okay. It's like so building a Shake script.
You have this thing, and this thing might be a counter.
John's holding
and you
up
say,
a card.
You say, I want it, and you fill out a form. You say, I want it to start at 10, and I want it to end at 80, and I want it to increment this fast.
Yeah.
And then that has a noodle that connects up to something else, which might be the X coordinate for the graphic.
Okay.
Okay, so now this thing is running, and it's counting from 10 to 110 at this rate, and this thing is going
up and down.
And down, just because it knows that that's what it's supposed to do. So the code to do this would be, you know,
for 10
variable equals 10, you know, plus, you know, two
sine oscillation,
semicolon, you know, and then you'd say what the operation is, and then, you know, repeat.
Yeah.
And if you forget the semicolons, it won't work. It won't compile. And then you go, oh, I forget semicolons. Or if you're doing a scripting language, it'll go syntax error, and the debugger will come up and like, what? Oh, yeah, colon.
Yeah.
This thing eliminates the formatting problems that you have with any scripting language.
Right.
And Quartz Composer really is one of those things in the Mac OS. It's in the existing Mac OS. Is this really powerful technology that people, I think, are just really beginning to realize is there. I mean, I played with it back when it was first announced, and it was just, for me, it was like, whoa, I don't have to do all this OpenGL coding and this low-level stuff to make things work. It was really awesome when I first played
it. Can you leverage something that you've done in Quartz Composer elsewhere? Can you bake it out, bake out an operation as some little widgety thing?
It basically QuickTime handles it.
Okay.
So you can
make Apple script work with it.
You can. Okay.
So anything that it can open and deal with a QuickTime frame can deal with a Quartz Composer thing.
Okay.
And so the Quartz Composer, so if you wanted to do, say, lower thirds that were based on an RSS feed for, you know, up to the minute whatevers, you could make that happen.
And so okay, so the, even the baked out little black boxes that are a bunch of nodes that will do something for you, those have inputs and outputs too. So you can feed it just a bunch of images if you wanted to outside of the context of Quartz Composer. Neat.
So the inputs can be a folder of pictures, for example. It can be an RSS feed. It can be a game controller. Fine. It could be a MIDI controller. It could be a sound input.
Right.
And then all that stuff can get output as well.
Cool.
And are you developing full apps in Quartz Composer, or is it just a tool to help you, write it?
So the thing is you can develop full-on apps inside of Quartz Composer.
They'd be limited.
No, they're not limited. They're actually really cool. So here's a good example. The WWDC calendar of events that were sitting on all the monitors, that was a Quartz Composer app.
Okay.
Right. And
Okay, right.
So
you can't do things like forms and those types of interface elements, right? But as far as display of something...
Anything that you'd want to display.
Right, okay.
You can do that. And I'm sure that eventually they'll have forms and they'll have other inputs. Right. But
because kiosk-y type stuff.
Yeah, kiosk-y kind of stuff. But here's the thing. You could hook up a motion detector or a pressure-sensitive plate or, you know, something so that when somebody walked up to something, it started to do its thing. You know, use that as the trigger to make it go. And that would be trivial to make that go.
In Quartz Composer.
In Quartz Composer.
Well, and the other thing that I saw that I was sitting there, and I only got to sit through half the session, unfortunately, because I had to run for a meeting, but was a guy in literally probably 10 minutes without writing a line of code, just using tools built into the Mac OS, do this amazing Ajax JavaScript database query system. I was sitting there like, he just dragged and dropped that entire code base. He didn't type a line of code to do
something that would take 4 days to make in the old days.
Yeah, I mean, I was just...
I saw a lot of things like that. I was
gosh.
Like, wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
He just... this stuff's just built in.
Drag, drop.
The JavaScript libraries in general are getting pretty robust. We were talking earlier about how drifting away from the metal. You know, there's JavaScript, the language, has all sorts of stuff you can do with it, including the sort of basic object, this XML HTTP request, I think is the name of the object.
Which is, basically.
That is the base of Ajax. It's two calls, really, right? Right.
Well, it's also the basis for dashboards.
Right.
Well, right. And right?
So
then,
this is kind of the glue. If you don't know this one thing, you're never going to be able to do the thing, the really cool stuff.
And yet, these libraries like Prototype, which I think they had something.
There was a session on Prototype.
Right. And then there's something that we use. There's an architecture that we use for some of our development in the Pixel Core that uses a library that is, again, on top of Prototype. So Prototype gives you all of this sort of functionality that you can use in Ajax to get your web applications done without having to write all of your own sort of low-level libraries about how you make the requests, what to do with the responses, how long to wait, that sort of thing. And then Scriptalicious is this one that we use a lot that is based on Prototype. So it uses all the plumbing the Prototype gives you, plus all the sort of animation fade in, fade out. It makes all that stuff really easy. So instead of writing all of your own routines for doing those things, you're just using the libraries that people have written for that. So the tools for making these interfaces are maturing rapidly too.
Rapidly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I remember literally maybe 2 years ago, I first started playing with what now is known as Ajax before it had a name. And I was like, oh, wow, I can do these calls now and I get this data feedback from the web or from systems. Yeah. And it to me, it was like this amazing, like, whoa moment of like, holy crap, this is going to change the way we do web stuff. And literally, I would say within 2 months of me realizing this and seeing it, Google Maps showed up.
Yeah.
And to me, that was the first what people call Web 2.0, Ajax used iframe application that was just like, someone did it finally. It made this app that runs entirely in a browser.
So are we seeing, are you guys seeing a convergence of what you're calling web, you know, apps for web and apps for, you know, computers?
Desktop.
Kind of like what we're seeing in video. We're seeing this, you know, film and video kind of coming together where it's no longer this distinction. Do you think that's happening? Or
to me, that is really what Web 2.0 is. People say, oh, Web 2.0 is Ajax or blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
Web 2.0, to me, is the application or true desktop-level application use through the web interface. It's a common interface that everyone knows. And I think Ben and I have talked about this before, is that, you know, it's changing the way you do things. That
but John
is
said
framework.
It set us back 20 years.
Well, no, it's catching up again. It's the thing. Web apps are starting to behave more like desktop apps.
Or you take one of these scripting languages and you build a you using WebKit, mm-hmm. build an app that knows how to talk to a specific website that you use pre-filled out fields. It feels and works exactly like a desktop application.
Like iTunes.
Like iTunes is an example, right? Mm-hmm. iTunes is an invisible web app, mm-hmm. right? You don't know that you're using a web app.
Right.
Because
except for the latency when you click and then it goes.
Except
and
for the latency, right.
Yeah.
When you're on this on the server side of,
but
right.
But internally, iTunes as a client on my machine, I don't notice any lag.
Oh no, I mean when you're speaking to the speaking to the store and stuff like that.
The web is still slow.
Yeah.
But yeah. A good example would be like, for example, I'm really frustrated by Google Maps all the time because I'll copy paste an address into the form.
Yes.
And it eats the carriage return.
Yes.
And it's like, why?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, don't eat the carriage return. Mm-hmm. Just deal with that. Just do the paste. Right. You know, make it a space.
Yeah.
And then give me the thing. And so if I made and it would be trivial to do this, make a web app, make an application that had that
space clear return. That
basically,
cleaner.
When I paste an address into it, or even just the idea that I switch to it, and the clipboard is parsed and it goes, oh, that's an address, and automatically draw the map without even me doing anything. That's a really cool application.
Which I think is happening in the new OS. I saw it on the website. Apple's building in some intelligent thing about moving addresses, recognizing addresses, in certain fields. And
we have all this processing power, right? We might as well parse the stuff, while it's there.
Yeah.
You know, we're moving it from place to place. Might as well, put a little bit of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually not even AI. It's just looking at going, oh, there's a comma, two characters, and five numbers. That's got to be an address.
Yeah. User convenience trickiness. I guess that's one of the other things that is sort of underlying, or I think one of the positive benefits of Web 2.0 is a focus again on the user as far as making those things easier. It shouldn't have to be this sort of
user experience.
You adapt yourself to the tool.
Yeah.
You're making the tools just smart and sort of try and do their best to anticipate what you're trying to do. And
there was a great presentation, and I'm not going to say who the company was, but they showed an application that when you first put the screenshot up, it was like, oh, that's a great looking interface. Mm-hmm. It looks like a pro app from the Apple Pro apps, and they're doing all this data management with it. And then they revealed just a little bit more, and suddenly you realized it's running in Safari. It's this beautiful looking interface. Until they revealed it, you would have never thought it was a web application. And then they revealed that it's running in the browser, and you're like, oh, okay, that's impressive.
Cool. Yeah. Right, and that's kind of important for everyone who wants to do things for the iPhone, certainly at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And maybe there won't be an SDK. I mean, maybe it won't be necessary. The only thing that would probably have to happen is people would want to have something where they'd have icon level apps but I don't know if that's even going to be necessary.
Well, it's a mixed bag having an SDK for the iPhone. There's a lot of people that want it, but there are some drawbacks.
I'm going to say this, and I've said this on the forum, and I've said this in a couple other places, but I don't know of a single product that's shipped as a 1.0 product with an SDK.
That's a good point.
You know, and I don't know what everybody's all up in arms about because, when the Mac first came out, it was tough to write. You had to have a Lisa in order to make a Mac.
No, that's great.
You know, there was no compiler for the Mac, right?
Yeah.
There was no developer tools, and it took them... You know, it took everybody working really fast until the summertime, until there was a C compiler, a Pascal compiler, and all the other things that were there.
Yeah.
And so this idea that, everybody's pissed because there's no tools, I'm like, get over it.
It hasn't even been launched yet.
It hasn't even been out. You know, we're days away from the thing, and of course we're not going to get an SDK. They're worried about shipping their product and testing it and making sure that it's the best user experience possible.
Mm-hmm.
Last thing they're ever going to do is ship an SDK so that people can have their dumb apps crashing the phone the day that it's out.
Yep.
That's not going to happen.
I would appreciate you not talking about my apps in that.
we took a look at them. We have to talk after show, Ben.
As long as you're not
as smart apps.
As long as you're not writing them in Python, then we're all okay.
You mean that snake language?
You know what? There's people that get their head around Python, and I do know this, that... Not Python. I'm sorry. Perl.
Oh, yes.
Perl.
I got it wrong. Perl.
Perl, Python.
Perl, Python. They both start with P, and they both start with
Anyway.
P. They both have vowels as well as that nasty P.
So, Craig, you were talking about some things that you were looking at that were very impressed with.
Well, me coming from the user experience and design point of view, I sat in on some sessions on Apple design standards and that kind of thing floats my boat. And obviously can't say much about it. It wasn't that terribly revealing, except that I really appreciated the level of detail they went into with the new Finder. And so, you know, the Finder for me has been this agonizing app up until now, and that it's just really gotten old in the tooth in terms of the graphic design, the look of it. Everything looked a little horsey to me, big, and I couldn't make things, certain things in the sidebar couldn't make them smaller, and it just, to me, became irritating. So I moved to Pathfinder, and, you know, I did that mainly for aesthetic reasons. So I was very delighted that the new Finder, that Steve mentioned the new Finder, and the actual layout is significantly better. Maybe it's not as kung fu as Pathfinder, but it certainly is a lot nicer. And this notion I had a few months ago when I sort of jokingly said on another show that iTunes really is System 11, the look of the interface of the Finder is the same as what they've started developing in iTunes in terms of that left column.
Well, and Steve even said that in the keynote, right? That, you know, the Finder is becoming more like iTunes.
Right. And I mean, it's all kind of clogging together, in my opinion. So I've been running, I don't know if any of you have run the Leopard yet.
Do you have an Intel or a G Max? I will say this, an Intel Max. Whoa.
Yeah.
Speed?
Holy crap. It's not necessarily even speed. It's a responsiveness. Mm. Mm-hmm. I can't say that it actually runs that much. Well, it does run faster, seemingly, but it just feels responsive.
Interesting.
I guess the easiest way to put it is that it feels like what the machine should be running at.
Yeah.
You've got this ultra powerful processor, and now you have a true 64-bit compiled OS.
Oh, right.
Whoa, it's hard to describe how it feels. I haven't run a ton of stuff in it yet. Yeah. I haven't done a ton of playing with it, but the little bit I've done is just,
wow.
Okay, that's cool.
Well, so this fixes the problem. I mean, the Finder is the oldest piece of code.
Yes.
It goes back to the next days. It was put together as quickly as possible so that there was something. And it's been the most ignored part of the Mac OS, of the Mac experience ever since, which is why tools like Quicksilver and Pathfinder and other things have become popular. And a good example of this, if you really want to understand the speed difference, is go to the command line, pick a folder, type in RM and the name.
Mm-hmm. No. What are you telling people, John?
Okay, I'm being funny.
Photos folder.
No. Actually, here's a better example.
John, that's danger.
Just type in LS.
There we go.
Okay, that's there you go.
Go to the Finder and type and pick a folder that has a lot of stuff and type in LS.
Okay.
And you'll get this really long list of stuff, and it goes, done.
Right.
And if you open a folder that's on your server, it'll grind and grind and grind, and sometimes it doesn't even do it, and you close the window and you open it again, and then it draws. It's like, what? And it's the most annoying thing, because whatever, I don't know all the bugs in the Finder, but I know that it hasn't been moved forward since the beginning.
Yeah.
5 years at least.
And functionally, it's actually not hugely different. I mean, the differences that I could see. Now, of course, there's a lot under the hood. But so far, in my short time that I've had it, it's mostly aesthetic, which to me were really the only major problems. I will say, however, that I know I talked with you, John, last week. My iMac G5 crashed, couldn't even put a disk in to get 10.4 loaded. Put in the Leopard test disk or the sample disk that we got, just fine.
Everything's fine.
And now I'm running it on my iMac G5.
So all that voodoo that we were talking
about
not necessary.
I don't know if I have bad installers of System 10.4. I had brand new disks. But anyway, it healed my...
I will say this, that I think I might actually go out on a limb, and I might actually install it as my primary OS on my laptop.
Dude.
And actually run it.
Are you really?
Well, because I've got two machines. So my primary work machine is a quad proc Mac Pro Tower system. That's where I do most of my production work.
Right.
But you know what? It just feels so cool. The first taste I got installing on a secondary drive and running it that I might, because I've got to send my machine in for repair. The keyboard's still kind of funky and all that. But once I get back, I might wipe it and literally install it in my primary OS just to test it and see what happens.
Yeah.
Speaking of what might happen, Ben, you were getting all excited about Final Cut and XML.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's, I don't, they did rev the spec to, I guess it's
for Studio
XML
too.
Version 4, I think, is of their specification. But I guess we haven't really talked about it on this show. No. Final Cut, and like a lot of applications now, Final Cut has an import-export, and they've had it for a while now. Mm-hmm. I think back 3 versions or something like that.
I think
like
version
that.
3 started.
Yeah. Yeah, version 3 was the first for XML export.
Right, right. So there's a specification by which you can get all your project data out as XML, and then get it back in again after transforming it if you want to. And this is great for an application that they talked about in the presentation that I hadn't even thought of, that this one studio is using it as an archive format. So because the Final Cut projects are still a binary file format, if you need to store your edits and all the information about that edit for long-term stuff, and mm-hmm. you want the data to be in a format that you know is going to be future-proof, if Final Cut goes away,
right, you have
it won't,
XML.
But if it goes away or becomes, you know, it's not something that is used widely anymore, instead mm-hmm. of being stuck with these files that represent your previous work,
right,
that you may need to extract some data from, even just saving out the XML as an archive format is something that people are excited about. But
it could be searchable too.
Right.
Well, because you can do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I mean, the biggest advantage of that would be that you could, you know, using Spotlight, you could have it go and search for text. So anytime you're looking for
a clip or something,
a specific piece of music because you need to be compliant, you could search for that and find all the instances.
So if you're using your naming conventions nicely, it means potentially.
Which everyone does.
Which everyone does, right? They all name their naming conventions. But if you use your naming conventions properly, then you literally, could search inside your Final Cut project.
So by naming conventions in this case, you mean the things that are in the bin
Naming conventions
inside the project. What you name your clips, what you name your sequences, all of the media
all
names,
of it.
Everything.
It all counts nowadays,
well,
kids.
And so all the templates I build for doing podcasts, I'm trying to be pretty strict about my name conventions even inside Final Cut now.
Yes.
So I have specific bin names that are always the same. I have project naming structure I'm following now in all my projects, and I try to maintain that because now I know if I can search on it and I have the XML version, boom, there it is.
And when it's in a text format like this, something we talked about in our presentation just briefly, but some of the stuff that we're working on internally now is being able to modify your Final Cut project. If you're working in a distributed environment and you need to do stuff like validate that one of your remote editors is following the conventions for what they name stuff, you can have, they upload to the server, you can validate, oh, Joe didn't name this, that, or the other, and kick it back in an automated fashion. Without anyone opening Final Cut, you can say your edit's bad and here's why. You can also assemble stuff if people are working on different projects and you know that needs to be combined in some programmatic way, like you're putting a multi-segment show together or something like that. And so pieces A, B, C, and D are done. The script puts those together. Someone locally opens up Final Cut, imports it. You got your finished sort of show.
Sounds like we're back to the command line shell script.
But for
the
stuff that doesn't...
For gluing it together, for sure.
That was the thing that I was actually surprised about was... Because I didn't hear this so much up until, I don't know, maybe this year, was just how much reliance macOS is on the command line for doing things. This isn't a bad thing, right? Because there's GUI extraction or abstractions of all the things that they're doing. Mm-hmm. But there's a high reliance on the idea that this command can be given, and there it goes. And there's a reason why this is important.
Well, that was the transformation of the Mac OS. I think that's why you have people moving now from a Windows OS, where you had a pseudo command line always. In every version of Windows, there was some version of the command line you could get there to. Wasn't necessarily always that powerful, but you could do a lot with it. But when the Mac OS suddenly had the full power of a Unix kernel with a full shell capability there, for anyone who's a hardcore coder, that totally changed the way you looked at the Mac, in my opinion.
Right. Well, part of this comes down to, it's exciting because about 10 years ago, I started predicting that we would have this stack of computers over in the corner, and that my computer in front of me that would be basically a GUI,
terminal.
A thing that did stuff, and then I would chuck off my really hard lifting to the thing in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And then that way, I didn't have to continuously upgrade my main CPU every 18 months to get the newest power.
Mm.
I can keep this thing around and have it work for, I don't know, let's call it 7 years.
Yeah.
And that my real power was happening in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that after seeing what I saw the last week this is a reality that's about to come true, that mm-hmm. you really want that, that tools like Cinema 4D and Final Cut and Podcast Producer, mm-hmm. which is a pretty amazing kind yeah. of thing. All these things leverage X-Grid, mm-hmm. and that X-Grid in so many ways is the future of basically beating Moore's Law once and for all.
Final Cut uses X-Grid?
Oh, yeah. You yeah. can definitely use.
And what is X-Grid?
X-Grid. In this,
when we're talking about languages and stuff, is it a language? Is it a
it's
layer?
It's an API. It's a protocol, but it's also an architecture.
Well, and at a simpler level, though, mm-hmm. it's a massive parallel computing system.
It's a way of sharing work amongst
our network computing system. I guess.
Okay. Network computing system. Yeah. So it's essentially the SETI project.
Yeah.
But for whatever you're doing.
That's what X-Grid does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Final Cut uses X-Grid. When?
Well, mainly things like compressor. So
compressor
you could
uses X-Grid for its...
Yeah, so you can set up this network yes. compression and have every machine on your network turn into right. a compression node.
Right.
So
right.
we did this today, right? Or yeah, Ben did yeah, this today.
We got it to work?
Yeah, it worked fine. Please, we were doing... Okay,
have you show me, because I've been trying for years to figure it out.
There's some stuff that's not intuitive about it at first, yeah. but it was something that we had done before, before we had gigabit on our yeah. on our network, mm-hmm. and we stopped using it because at the time, the amount of data we wanted to push around to all the machines mm-hmm. was
prohibitive,
was exceeding the capacity of the network. So yeah. we weren't getting the gains that you would get on a faster network. But it's working well now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where the hub's going to totally not be happy.
Yes,
the hub. Indeed. The you're hub. Still using a hub?
No. I mean, if you have a hub, then you're only using half of your network.
I've yeah. turned mine all into fish tanks for very small fish.
Yeah. Yes, hubs are bad in a network.
Now, this is just new to me. Cinema 4D is X-Grid enabled? I didn't realize it. I know they have a distributed
Well, they have
render.
A distributed version, Same and I think though. They're going to move to X-Grid.
Interesting.
That would be cool.
Yeah, it would be great.
That there's no reason for them not to, because it makes it easier for them to deploy their multiprocessor mm-hmm. piece.
Yeah, yeah, the generic framework for it, that's the benefit too, is that you can... It's there to be used by either existing applications that are Apple applications to use it, or you could write anything that you need to distribute work on or what would benefit from having multiple processors two on it can be piped into this, and you can use the framework without having to write all of that part of it.
And it's a faceless app, which means that you're only caring about the output. You don't have to worry about a whole lot of other stuff that's going along. Mm.
And as far as coding goes, I mean, it's stuff that's built into the coding kits on the Mac OS. Mm-hmm. So a lot up till now, or up till recently, really the only people that are taking advantage of it is people that could code, and or people that were writing like scientific applications where they needed these massive processing systems where they need to have tons of processors online to crunch yeah. on large mathematical equations.
Right.
So
we saw the instantiation of it with Podcast Producer, which is right. a new thing for Leopard.
Now, I want to start by saying that Podcast Producer, as cool as it is not really going to benefit the individual person who's got a podcast.
Right.
It's for large organizations.
So right. if you have a university or an enterprise or, you know, some place mm-hmm. that is
cranking
in
out.
Production, you know, having something recorded every single day or multiple times a day,
yeah.
this is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, it is.
But if you're just the individual person, you're mm-hmm. better off with a tool like Ubercaster, mm-hmm. which is from ubercaster.com, mm-hmm. Because it basically has a workflow that it's very similar to mm-hmm. the way that Podcast Producer works, but it's only on
the
your one machine.
Yeah.
And so mm-hmm. when you're done recording, you press go, and it chucks off your podcast, and there you are.
One other compression app that uses X-Grid is Visual Hub.
Oh, right.
Oh,
so
really?
Visual yeah, it's Hub, X-Grid-enabled. It's one of the reasons why I like Visual Hub is it's X-Grid enabled. So
oh, okay.
you can do like Apple TV compressions yeah. and things like that using right. Visual Hub also.
Yeah.
This is just my naivete. Is X-Grid its own thing, or is the QMaster the gateway to using X-Grid?
I think you can use X-Grid entirely independently
yeah, okay.
QMaster.
Yeah.
QMaster is the built-in capability. It started with Shake and then went into Final Cut.
Right.
And basically, it's mainly for the pro apps. So QMaster is really kind of,
does
think
it predate X-Grid?
If I remember right, it does.
Okay.
X-Grid came out afterwards. So
X-Grid is the future, though. Hmm. Speaking of the future, Time Machine.
Hmm.
They announced no ZFS.
Yeah, I have some insight into this, and yes. One of them is that let's say that ZFS wasn't ready yet, mm-hmm. okay, and they're looking at their schedule and they go, you know what, we need another 4 months to test mm-hmm. because we have to certify this,
right?
Right, mm-hmm. because this
it's a major switch.
It's a major switch to the mm-hmm. OS. So I believe that this was one of those features that was really cool. Happy to have it. Would have wanted it in a major way, but if it's not going to be finished. Because it is a file system.
Yeah.
It has to be 100%.
Right.
And the fiasco that we had with folder or a file vault when that thing shipped.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, where people were losing their whole entire mm-hmm. life because mm-hmm. it didn't work in
they
the 1.0.
They locked their home directory and lost everything.
Exactly. It's a good example of, you know, jumping yeah. too soon. And,
yeah.
And I, in this case, happy to wait. You mm-hmm. know, we'll definitely implement it when it comes out, even if it's only an OS X server.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have to be on the desktop. I'm really only caring about this from a you know, I need to keep my work group data
right.
Alive and around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll deploy it there when it comes out.
Yeah.
But anyway, a couple of things that I learned about Time Machine.
Mm-hmm.
If you are an individual who has a large number of machines, who's been waiting for Time Machine as your end-all solution for backing up your lots of people, this is not the technology for you.
Hmm.
It's designed for the individual.
It's designed for the individual or the really, you know, the work group where you can put a hard drive with each one of the computers that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And
it needs a second drive. Is that correct?
It needs a second drive. Well, it can go to a network volume.
Yeah. Okay.
But imagine that you have 30 machines and you're trying to back up 30 machines to that. That means you're going to have a pretty badass network infrastructure to make go. And have that anyway, but that initial everybody loading their...
With the amount of video I'm generating on a per minute basis, you don't want to...
No, you don't.
You wouldn't want to be on a net with Ben.
So yeah. You don't want to be on a net with Ben.
Will not be your
Ben
friend.
Is a node of one.
Right.
But, isn't that why there's multiple network cards in the Power and Mac Pros, right?
That's right. Yeah, one for my stream and one for everything else.
The other thing is if you're waiting for Time Machine to back up, don't wait. Go get your hard drive today and start backing up tomorrow.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because
you don't want to lose all that code.
You don't want to lose all of the everything between now and then.
Yes.
And there's a lot of great solutions that are out now
mm-hmm.
that you should be using.
We talked about that
before. We did. Reference the last show, but don't wait for Time Machine.
That would be a good... I'm not condoning this, of course. That would be a good virus, because it seems like...
Hold on.
What, the backup virus?
The fake out.
So the problem, of course, is that until you really lose something, mm-hmm. it's really hard to convey to someone what it's going to feel like for them to lose something important until they really lose it. So what you want is the virus that... And of course, this would be impossible to write, but you find everyone who hasn't experienced real data loss. You give them that data loss, back everything up for them, but you give them a week to experience what that's like.
Yeah.
And then you invite them to back up. I think it would sink in that
No.
Okay.
You know what? Because the users never learn. That's why we put
even
an L.
Even if they get burned,
that's why we put an L in front of the word user.
I don't know. I've never met anyone who hasn't
like
lost a hard
IT.
Drive that at least heeds the warnings about that. It's usually not a twice repeated phenomenon. But
no, so, I just this think, you know, if a meteorite hits this right now, how am I going to feel? It's always the meteorite thing.
The meteorite's
really
going to take you out too. You're going to really
aggro about it, baby.
Do you mind sharing
super duper
set aggressiveness?
Super duper every day, at minimum, sometimes twice. And then if I'm on a project that's really important, I will do a chronosync to an external drive every 15 minutes.
I love it.
And just back up that folder that I'm working on. Cause
that is one backed up individual.
Just one copy of data is charming, man.
FireWire 800 all the way.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say that after sitting in on the session, I am so impressed with iChat Theater and the apps that are going to come out of this.
Yeah. I didn't see the session, but I talked with the guys.
Yeah, I missed it. Fill me in.
This is an industry-changing thing.
It's really...
Oh, is it the putting...
The screen sharing, right? So the idea is that it's as simple as opening a chat with somebody
mm-hmm.
and then start adding things to it.
Okay. What's compositing stuff on the fly for you? Or?
Well, no. So in this case, I might have a client on the phone, right?
Mm-hmm,
and I want to go over the changes with them. So I open up the iChat.
Yeah.
I'm having a conversation with them on the
right.
the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, I open up, oh, well, here's the graphics that we're working on. Poof. Bing. And they're up. And then we're having the conversation mm-hmm. about that stuff.
Yeah. It's a screen sharing thing?
Well, you can share. Yeah. You can share because of the technology called...
The Quick Look?
Quick Look, yeah.
That's a core, anything as that you, an app.
Or, right. Anything yeah. that you can open in Quick Look, yeah. you can share in iChat Theater.
Right.
Hmm.
Right.
So, which is virtually anything in the OS.
Which is virtually anything. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty close. It's Quick Look's like a preview.
I think what they're basically doing is...
They're making an image of it and sending it across.
They're doing mm-hmm. what WebEx does or what any of the other sharing applications up till now have done. The interesting thing to me is that Apple really is kind of the last player to come into this space. Hmm. I mean, Microsoft's been doing it years from with NetMeeting, mm-hmm. even right. though, I mean, trust me, I've worked with NetMeeting all too much.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very familiar with it and WebEx, and I played with all those technologies in a former life at another company, and, mm-hmm. you know, I think Apple's actually hitting it at a time when network performance is actually there to do it, and that the systems have changed enough. We understand enough about how to compress data across the network now mm-hmm. that it could be a really great user experience.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. to me, most of those applications, WebEx was the first to really say, oh, okay, this is actually pretty interesting for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it still had some limitations, and to have it built in the OS kind of like a Timbuktu, if any of you guys have ever used
Timbuktu. Mm-hmm. Right.
It's some of Timbuktu's capabilities built in iChat, which is pretty cool.
Well, you're not controlling another machine, but you are sharing a screen. You're sharing a display.
I thought, can you control someone else's machine remotely with it?
Not with iChat.
There's the Back to My Mac
product. Which is different. That's right.
And which is just a data thing. It's not, not a screen control.
It's basically, it's figuring out the NAT problem based on your .Mac.
Right,
logging. Which is very cool, actually.
Right, but it's not a screen sharing thing. It's just a data.
It can be.
Thing.
I think I thought it could be.
I heard it was
no,
not.
No, there's a whole
Maybe
bunch
not.
Of
okay.
so there's a whole bunch of stuff that that Back to My Mac is going to enable because mm-hmm. it's an API because we can the developer can make this
mm-hmm.
go.
Mm-hmm.
There will be apps that are going to be Back to My Mac enabled that will be just like you know it'll
Did you
be
feel
well it'll okay. be chicken of the VNC with another hook.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. That's another
or spy
one. Me. So whether they're bouncing shared files off of people's .Mac and mm-hmm. transparently instead mm-hmm. of trying to do direct connection stuff.
Well no. The idea is that when you're trying to find the biggest problem when you're trying to do screen sharing is finding somebody's IP address. And it's also trying to find somebody and also trying to get through somebody's firewall.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So those are the two problems. So you either have to poke a hole in the firewall mm-hmm. and know the IP address, or you have to come up with something like DIN DNS to make mm-hmm. it go back. So most people don't know even what that is, nor do they know how to poke a hole in their router. So this is the only solution.
So basically, it's you opt in your computer to this Back to My Mac thing, like at home, and... Then when you're on the road, you go to your .Mac account, and it's already keeping track of all that stuff with your home computer. So you can just link right in and pull files off of it via .Mac.
Okay.
So it's just solving all of this whole...
Right, .Mac has basically become the middleman, will become the middleman managing it, which is pretty cool.
Which will be very... I think it's... I think
.Mac
also
account
a little
has
scary,
super
node. Scary about it.
Finally something to pay the $100 a year for.
Yeah.
Well, seriously, that is a big, big deal, especially if I have to configure somebody's computer across the country. Like, mm-hmm. I'll gladly pay the $100 mm-hmm. so that I don't have to... Say, okay, now go to the... No,
part of my service call for you is to pay $100 and buy .Mac.
Exactly.
So with iChat, it's very cool. It opens up potentials, too, for podcasters and for screencasters and, you know, these
Anybody
things
who,
that...
Well, and educators, mm-hmm. trainers.
Especially we can get to a one-to-many kind of thing.
Collaboration in general, though, to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really will make the part of the Mac OS that, for me, has been kind of missing... In doing a collaborative environment.
Yeah. Now, for me, the roundabout would be, okay, we had iTunes come into Windows and infiltrate with WebKit, which made Safari into Windows very easily. Mm-hmm. Easy, right? Because it's just a few more bits to WebKit. So now you see iChat for Windows. Then we've got it cooking. Now, I realize that's not going to happen because I've learned iChat's relying on these things like Core Animation and
Core
all
OS
these
things
that no Windows machine's going to pull off. Do they have a similar thing on Windows? Do they have
DirectX? Is probably the closest. I mean, it's really a DirectX is a graphical language, mainly developed for games, and that's why game developers have developed on PC partly for so long. Is because it was so easy. There was this graphical
abstraction layer that they can take advantage of and write all these cool graphics things with.
The Xbox supports it too, of course, because it's Microsoft, so it makes porting, you know, making games. A game that's going to work on both platforms very easily because the underlying graphics libraries are the same.
Okay, but in terms of all these layers of core audio and video and animation we've got on the Mac.
Windows machines do not have the same level, partly because Apple is very cognizant of trying to maintain a hardware level of control that you can't get on a Windows machine, period. I mean, it's just you can't have that same level of control because there are umpteen manufacturers, you know, everyone from Dell to Compaq to, or HP. Well, I guess Compaq doesn't exist anymore, HP, to,
plus the 20 Gateway. OEMs for all the video cards.
Exactly. So
it's just it's the compatibility problem. They have to make concessions in order to maintain a wide variety of hardware compatibility. Mm-hmm.
There you go. There's the core difference right there, kids.
It is the cement shoes.
Yes.
That particular thing.
Hey, Lenny, come here. We're going to give you some cement shoes.
I would love
shoes.
To walk faster, but cement shoes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or the cruel shoes.
No, I mean, to me, though, it was interesting. This Worldwide Developer Conference also just had a different feel because I've gone in one form or another for the past, I think, 3 years. And this year just had a different energy to it. It had a different feel to it.
What was it like? Because I felt something too. But I'd be curious to hear what you say, what you felt.
It was an excitement level that I've not felt out of a Worldwide Developer Conference. The other thing to me is there were a lot of new Mac developers here.
Yeah.
A substantial number of people. I mean, in the past, it's been pretty much, you know, you get a smaller new influx, but it wasn't like this year. I mean, it was the largest Worldwide Developer Conference I think they've ever had.
5,000 people.
Do you know by how much? For contrast, how many were at the last few years?
I don't.
I think last year there were around 3,000 people.
That sounds right. I don't have
That's a significant jump. Yeah.
But it definitely, there was a different energy about it. Now, I don't know if it was because it was held in Moscone West, if it was compared
to... But it was in Moscone West last year.
Was it?
Yeah. I think that part of the difference is that this year, and they did this last year, but this year it was really clear that they had more than developer tracks.
And so that was a focus.
They had media tracks. They had IT tracks. They had
they had people. I mean, like ourselves, we did a presentation, as did Alex. There were people outside of Apple there extolling the virtues of developing and using this system, and maybe that was part of it, is that there are people who are truly excited about it. They're presenting also.
That's news to me. Where there is the IT and the sysadmin tracks, are those new?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So those I haven't well, been before. I'm not
no,
sure.
No, actually, they were there a year ago.
But they're relatively new.
But they were there weren't that many of them, and there was really no reason for that person to come.
Yeah.
And I think that with the technologies that we've talked about, which are, you know,
X-Grid.
Podcast producer, Time Machine.
The new emphasis on web technologies.
The web technologies. Mm-hmm. The idea of deploying OS X as a server for example, iCal server has a part. There's a new...
the iCal dev stuff, you mean? Yeah, that's going to be very cool.
There's the wiki that's built into OS X server.
Right,
now.
That's new.
There's... the blog tool that's built in.
Is there press? Maybe I missed some of that.
Yeah, it's all there. I mean, there's a whole ton of... So we'll do a show specifically on OS X server because there's so much technology that's there.
I've been a big fan of the OS X server for several years. When I first started using one, I was like, oh, this is how a server should run.
Yeah, it's really
click,
fun.
Click, I'm done. No command line code. Well, there's still some of that, definitely, but... Yeah.
I think there's going to be less command line in OS 10.5 server than there has been in the past.
Oh, I agree. Because, I mean, in my opinion, the current version is pretty good, but there are some things I'm just like, oh, I got to go around. I got to do this code. And it's actually because there's a GUI there, it's actually more convoluted than if there was no GUI. So some of the things are just awesome. You go click, click, and you're done. But other things,
making a work group and dragging people into it.
Yep. Yeah.
That makes it really easy. Instead of trying to type that's not fun.
Well,
what do we have anything else we need to cover? Let's see. Ajax, iframes, Quartz
what are
composer
iframes.
So had to get that answer.
I personally really like the technology. A lot of developers don't like them. The word frames for web developers is this bad word.
I remember frames are terrible.
But the cool thing about iframes is they're they're compliant with the newer code sets. And the advantage is they're CSS compliant, things like that. You can use them using modern technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically lets you embed a web page inside of another one.
But the eyes for inline.
Inline frames, basically. So a perfect example of this is the cover flow looking feel of the new Mac website. So
yes.
When you go there and you go to the hardware products and you have that scroll bar up along the top, that's an iframe. So it's a separate page of just basically clickable icons in a scrolling area. And you click on those and it refreshes the main web page. I did this, probably 4 or 5 years ago. I did a photo gallery where I could actually go in there and all my photos were in this inline piece. Uh-huh. And you could scroll through them really quickly as thumbnails and you click on it and then brought the high-res one up below it.
Hmm.
So when I saw that, I was like, oh, I know what that is. I mean, I've done that before. So
what's new? What's new about it?
It's just that
compatibility for one.
But yeah, that's a big one actually. But also,
so the Safari is compatible. What's compatible?
Each of the browsers kind of handled them differently up till recently.
It's a cross-browser problem. Yeah. You can make them work really well in one browser, and they would be not.
So were there standards developed that Apple's not complying
with? Yeah, W3C has a standard for it, and most all the browsers comply to that standard now for the most part.
Now, was the iPhone...
But it's also a people getting past the word frame, in my opinion.
Because
developers had for such a long time, I mean, frames were a pain in the butt.
They were. They were ugly.
It was a good idea gone bad.
Exactly. Right. But iframes, in my opinion, are the proper direction to head with it. And it opens up all kinds of possibilities, especially when you start mixing with JavaScript and Ajax capabilities and things like that.
So what's new is that Safari supports it and the iPhone supports it?
Well, it's just that a large company is really emphasizing the use of it.
Okay.
And it sounds like the iPhone will require the use of them for certain technologies.
Require? So,
really? For you to make a really good iPhone experience,
right.
I think it will require the use of iframes.
Okay, so like this flowing animation-like stuff.
Yeah, if you want that
cover flow-like.
Or if you have your Apache server configured to say, oh, this is Safari on the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So now I can chuck down a different iframe.
Yep.
Instead of this big thing, I can make something small. Have the person have the same experience. It's just that it's not it's just not for the desktop.
Not unnecessary bits going
right.
down
and so because you can do that, you get that experience for free.
Yep.
Actually, you don't get the experience for free. The experience is the same.
You know, it changes the way you can develop for the web again. And again, the first example I saw someone using it after I found them and started playing with them was, again, Google Maps.
Right.
Google Maps, to me, is one of the perfect examples showing you its use of iframes, of Ajax, of all these different technologies in one interface.
Yeah. So. All they need is a carriage return remover, and they're good.
Which John's going to write for us.
So your homework,
if
you want to be part of this whole thing, is... download the Dash Code beta, and you don't have to have the whole entire developer kit on your machine in order to play with Dash Code, but Dash Code is available. You have to actually sign up for the ADC, the Apple Developer Connection.
Which is free.
You have to give up some information.
At the base level.
But you don't have to give up a credit card. And if you already have...
Or blood sample.
If you already have a Apple account, either a .Mac account or just... you've registered with Apple, then you can use your email address and it'll just turn that on and there you go. You don't have to re-sign up. So Dash Code, if you're searching for it, just search for Dash Code beta, download it, make it the quickest, easiest one to do is a countdown timer. You'll have it done in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. I'll put my countdown timer on, see how fast I do it.
Make a countdown timer to do a countdown timer.
It's a countdown timer instancer.
Exactly. So I have to figure out how to make a countdown timer to make a countdown timer to keep track of how long it took me to do that. All right. Maybe we'll post a countdown timer somewhere so that you can actually download a countdown timer and then try it out while you're counting down toward...
It should download. It should search the web for countdown timers and download all the
countdown timer search
evaluate
engine.
Them. Yeah. Based on there, yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to do a wrap up here and then we're gonna go play with Dash Code. So to my right is Kenji Kato.
Oh, me.
Yeah,
Kenji.
You.
Yeah. I guess I'm to your right.
His right.
And to
as
my
opposed to stage right.
Exactly. Stage right. Stage right.
Don't confuse me.
Stage left. to my left, not that would be stage right. Ben.
Hi. Ben Durbin. Pleasure to be here. Good to be back, as it were.
And then the subtitles first time on MacBreak Tech.
Well, thank you for having me. I was excited about WWDC. I don't want to break the flow of the show otherwise.
Of course, I'm
just here this week just because I wanted to be, because I was excited.
Well, and it's good getting a person who's not into code as much as we are, probably, a perspective sometimes.
Yeah, I know. But this, you know, like John said, if it's too complicated, they're going to move on anyway.
Exactly. You're going to have to just go look it up for yourself.
That's right.
Well, thanks, Craig, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm John Foster, and we'll see you on the other side.